This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast for January 7th. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. Happy New Year to everybody. So, Jackie, how was your time away in holidays?
It was great. It went faster than I thought. You know, at the beginning, you think 2 weeks seems like a long time, but
it's always a blink of an eye.
Yeah.
Especially when you have family and around, it just seems to go really quickly.
Yeah.
But it was good.
Yeah. When you have to host family, cook all those meals.
That's right. Yeah. No, was Santa good?
Yeah, Santa was good and got some skiing in. And so, yeah, it was
good,
fun.
Good. All good. Well, it was the end to an incredible year. We're going to talk about 2019 as a foundation for looking into 2020. So what's on the agenda?
Right. So look back on 2019. What were the big events that shaped the year? And many of these events we talked about on the podcast. Mm-hmm. So just a quick summary of what we think were the key elements of the year. And then second part, think about the big questions looking forward into 2020. And boy, the year got off to a start on January 3rd there with the Iranian situation. And so we'll talk about that as well.
Yeah. It looks like it's going to be a dramatic year in terms of the geopolitics, but we'll come back to that. First of all, let's look back on 2019. I mean, it was a pretty good year fiscally for the Canadian oil and gas industry.
It was, and you put a tweet out at New Year's that showed the revenue and cash flow numbers, and the revenue hit nearly $115 billion. Cash flow was about $50 billion Canadian. And that's really strong numbers. In fact, not so far off from a cash flow perspective what the industry had in that 2011 to 2013 period when the price of oil was $100 a barrel. So a very strong year from that perspective.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to recognize and understand is that the cash flow, the revenue minus your costs, basically on a cash basis, was as big at, what did we average, $57 a barrel?
Yeah, it was $57 a barrel.
And a de minimis natural gas price when we were $100+ a barrel. That means that there's more production since then, but more importantly, it means also that there was substantial cost realizations that happened over the course of the 5 years between 2014 and 19.
Yeah, definitely the lower operating costs, especially for the oil sands. We haven't really seen as much cost cutting in the non-oil sands, but on the oil sands side, that was significant. But the biggest factor was that oil sands production doubled from 2011 to this year. So from 1.6 million barrels a day to 3 million barrels a day. And so although it looks good that we have all that cash flow, the reality is the industry had to work twice as hard to get the same cash flow as they did before. So, you know, that's on the headline, it looks good, but the reality is it's not the same world.
Yeah.
We are producing way more oil to generate the same amount of cash flow.
But I think the bigger news was that the cash flow did not go back into the ground nearly as much as it did in 2014, nor was there any debt and equity. We talked a lot about that in 2019. Mm-hmm. And the big question for 2020, which we'll come to, is, you know, what does the industry look like in terms of its spending, which translates into employment and royalties and taxes and all sorts of things that are relevant to all of us as stakeholders.
Right. And that's exactly it. Doesn't feel like it did in that 2011 to 2014 period because we're spending a lot less relative to how much cash we're generating. Okay, so we'll post those numbers so people that want to look at them all can look at them.
Mm-hmm.
We also, on our ARC charts, which come out weekly, we have a table at the back, that
page
shows all those numbers. In fact, that's probably what I'll put the link to.
Yeah.
And you can get every detail you want in terms of the industry spending and also the revenue levels of the different years.
It was the year of the election last year. Elections, plural, wasn't it?
Yeah, we had Alberta and Canada. So April 16th, the United Conservative Party wins the majority here in Alberta, led by Jason Kenney. And his policies have been supportive of the oil and gas industry. And, you know, some of them include the curtailment that's been extended to 2020 for oil.
Mm-hmm.
Crude by rail over curtailment level, which is a new policy, which I think we're going to start to see the impacts of this year. Another really positive policy that occurred last year was the Alberta government led the industry to make some temporary changes to the policies that are used on our regional gas gathering system. And that has resulted in much stronger prices since that policy has been put in. It's expected to remain in 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, let's quickly talk about the Canadian federal election. So that was held on October 21st, and we elected a minority Liberal government led by Justin Trudeau. And we had a podcast on that, as we did with the Alberta government election.
Yep.
The other big news in 2019, it feels longer ago, but on the federal side is we did have those two controversial bills that were passed into law.
48 and 69.
Yes, yeah. So I was like, did that really happen all last year? But yeah, that did happen in the beginning of the year.
It was a very unsettling year in many ways, unsettling in a sense that there was just a lot of anxiety in the business. You know, and we actually came into 2019 with a lot of anxiety because it was the late 18 was when we had those differentials that were so wide. The curtailment policy on oil had just come in. It was a very difficult start to the year.
Real uncertainty in real, terms of where the price was going. I think there's a lot feeling of much more stability today
in terms of domestic prices, in terms of domestic prices and so on. So, okay, I don't think we need to do any historical review of the federal election other than what does it mean in terms of TMX and things like that.
Well, and so let's talk about the expanded takeaway capacity from Western Canada. Although it feels like nothing happens on this front, things have happened in the last year. For example, TMX did get the green light. We actually saw pictures of the construction
right before
Christmas.
Yeah,
so that's happening. Enbridge Line 3 did have a setback because of the need to expand the environmental review around Lake Superior. Enbridge Line 3 is a replacement project, an existing line that travels all the way into the Midwest from Canada. And that line exists today, but they want to replace it and they can double the capacity of the line by doing that. It's an important project because it would increase the takeaway capacity out of Western Canada, but it was delayed. It's been delayed a number of times. That said, there's some news that that's kind of back on track and there's still the potential that that could be constructed this year.
Yeah.
Now, the other big news that was unexpected this time last year is that we had news that we can actually do additional expansions to our existing pipelines by debottlenecking, running them more efficiently. So over 250,000 barrels a day of new capacity is expected to come online because of those types of announcements.
So that's like a third of a Keystone XL.
Yeah, like it's significant, right? The pipeline companies keep amazing me. If you look at the Enbridge mainline, it moves almost 1 million barrels a day of crude today more than it did several years ago due to these types of activities.
So that's more than a Keystone XL just right there.
Yeah, it's like 20% more than a Keystone XL. These pipeline companies continue to optimize and find more space. So
it sounds like the reality is that between these sorts of capacity additions and additional rail, that the capacity overall is expanding.
It is. The other thing I want to highlight, and there's a couple of news announcements in December, and people might have missed them as they were going out for the break, but we finally had some people announce that they're going to do these diluent recovery units. So we had James Cairns come on our podcast early last year and talk about the fact that if we, instead of moving the diluted bitumen, we move pure bitumen in the rail cars, we could actually have economics that are similar to pipeline. And that's because we're not moving all that extra diluent that you don't really need. And he made the case that we need to shift to that mode so that rail can become a long-term mode of transport out of Western Canada and an economic one. So we had two announcements, one Gibson Energy and USD announcing a joint venture to construct a project at Hardisty, 100,000 barrel a day, could be in service by 2021. And Cenovus applied for 190,000 barrel a day unit. So to me, this is huge news. Like we're diversifying our transportation in a way that will be sustainable long-term because its economics are quite good and competitive with pipe.
Right. This is big news that the industry, as we had talked about, I think, post James Cairns interview, is becoming more diversified or more flexible in its transportation options. And that's important, not to be so reliant on a couple of pipelines to get the product to market.
Back in 2011-12, I was talking about the need for these. Mm-hmm. And we were running the economics and showing producers that, hey, this could work. And, you know, and producers were always, well, we're going to get a pipeline. So, you know, it doesn't really make sense. And these announcements had some cost estimates. Like, I mean, these are hundreds of million of dollar investments. And if you think you're going to get a pipeline, you don't want to make that investment.
Right.
And so if we had invested in these back in that 2011-12 period, things would look a lot different in Western Canada today.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to see we're moving forward with some of these ideas.
I think a combination of all these dynamics is really setting the industry up to be more resilient in the 2020s. The lowering of the cost structure, the diversification of the transportation options, and of course, the announcements that now some of these companies are going to do dramatic things to reduce their emissions.
Right. So that's the other big news for 2019 is we had two Canadian oil sands producers make net zero greenhouse gas emission pledges. CNRL, Steve Lott, who came on our podcast in July, explained their plan, but their goal is on the upstream side to have no emissions at some point in the future. He hasn't put a year out there, but he has a bunch of technologies that they're working on that they think they can achieve that. And they also mentioned they're not doing it through offsets. They think they can do it, you know, on their direct emissions.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, actually, we had Steve on the show making the no net emissions well before the federal election and well before the prime minister talked about being net zero by 2050.
Yeah, that's a great point.
We've got Meg Energy as well.
Yeah, so later on, Derek Evans, the CEO of Meg Energy, announced they have a plan to become net zero as well. And I do hope that we'll see more producers in 2020 make aggressive targets for GHG reductions.
Yeah, I think we will. And that leads to the whole cleaner side of the economy. And we would be remiss not to talk about the renewable energy developments.
Yeah, and 2019 was a big year for renewables because in Alberta, the NDP had put in some policy to support more renewable energy. We are going to see a big increase in renewable energy from about 2,700 megawatts of existing capacity to about 4,000 with the three different auctions that were held. What those auctions proved is that wind power in Western Canada can be highly competitive. Those auctions went for 3.7 to 4 cents per kilowatt hour, which is cheaper than natural gas by most estimates.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that means that we're going to see growth in renewables in Alberta. And of course, the new UCP government has stopped future auctions. There was a fourth one planned for June of 2019, but that was canceled. Yet, the head of Canadian Wind Energy Association, Evan Wilson, if you remember,
he came in on our podcast.
He believes that due to the record low prices that were demonstrated by these auctions and the world-class wind resource that Western Canada has, he believes we'll continue to see new investment in renewables even without the government policy. He also referenced the fact that the Alberta government policy for industrial emitters does create some incentives for large emitters to offset some of their GHG emissions. So there is some motivation for big oil sands companies that need to reduce their emissions to meet the industrial targets to go and support wind farms as well.
Yeah, I think that in some ways, the notion that the government is not supporting these things is a good thing because we want the free market dynamic of competitive renewables. In other words, competing on cost to be able to come in. Yeah, that's when you get true adoption is when it is actually cost competitive without any sort of subsidization. And I think in many jurisdictions around the world, including here in Alberta, where we have actually already quite low power prices to begin with, this is a big trend. And the solar side was active too. I mean, there were several solar projects that were approved and are ready to go. And that's what I like to say is that Alberta really has it all when it comes to energy resources. We have the oil and the gas in abundance, of course. We have the wind and the sun. And it's all coming together. And I think when all these energy systems start working together, we'll also be able to demonstrate that we'll have some of the most sustainable energy resources in the world here.
Well, and you know, the Canadian Energy Regulator thinks so too. They put out annual report that they put out called Canada's Energy Future. And they show that today, Alberta's electricity generation from solar, wind, and geothermal is third place behind Ontario and Quebec. But by 2040, Alberta leads the country. And they predict that the growth will be six times versus today's level in terms of the magnitude of generation coming from those sources.
Yeah, so, and there's some interesting geothermal things going on, which we can address in a later show.
Yeah, that would be great. Okay, so let's talk about some of the global energy themes. I think one of the biggest news stories of the year was climate pressure heating up. You know, it started with that alarming report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, at the end of 2018, which we did cover on a podcast. And that really sounded the alarm in terms of needing to change the GHG emissions reductions and do it more fast. So they basically said to avoid the most serious impacts of global warming, we need to keep warming less than 1.5 degrees C, or a 45% reduction by 2030 and a net zero target by 2050. And that has led to many countries,
I think it's like 77 countries or something have signed on to this net zero by 2050.
Yeah, and that all happened in 2019.
I mean, the interesting thing is that the notion of net zero and dramatically reducing carbon emissions has been pounding on the oil and gas industry for 5 years. And I actually think the signs that we saw in 2019 is that by 2050, certainly it can be done. Other industries that have yet to realize the sort of pressure, it's going to be interesting to watch.
And one other thing is I think there's more public awareness of the problem too. And the 16-year-old climate activist Greta Thunberg rallied young people. And I don't think that's going to change. And that was a new trend in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, the upshot of all this is that we can't expect the ESG pressure to ease up.
Okay, but on the flip side, you know, we got the pressure heating up, but the action isn't really matching.
No, the action's not there.
So a couple of examples from this year, electric car sales have slowed significantly in the second half of the year, and it looks like the sales this year of new electric cars are not going to be much higher than the previous year, not growing.
Yeah.
It's still growing, but not the pace of growth is not increasing. And renewable investment slowed. Bloomberg News Energy Finance came out with a report at the end of the year saying that 2018 was the first time since 2001 that the growth in renewable power capacity additions failed to increase year on year, and they think 19 was also very weak. So although the world wants to move to electric cars and renewable energy, we're actually not seeing the levels of investment that would put us on that
path. I think
path.
We talked about it in one of our podcasts from last year. You would have to at least triple to quadruple the amount of investment that's going into renewables to even come close to the targets that are being outlined from all this climate pressure that's heating up. There's just a complete mismatch. And I think that this is going to be a story to follow as we go into the early 2020s, as we go forward. And necessarily, it means that industries that are heavy emitters in manufacturing, including and resources like oil and gas, are going to have to be part of the solution.
Right. Well, you're not going to make these major reductions without it. No. But definitely more, a lot of talk, a little less action. That's what we're seeing in 19.
Yeah.
The last thing that I wanted to highlight that was a major change in the year is we saw a big fall in the equity prices for oil and gas producers. And we had a podcast with that, and a couple of podcasts on that topic, especially the one with Eric Nuttall that we had in the fall. And even though prices have started to recover, like equities have moved up, especially with the Iranian situation that started in January, still the stock values are much lower than they were the same time this year when oil prices were $50.
Don't you mean a year ago?
Yeah, if we go back a year ago, not true for every stock, but a lot of stocks are not even at the level that they were in January of 2019 when the oil price was closer to $50.
Yeah, I think it was under 50 actually, and now we're closer to 65 or something. So, well, that's a good cue to move into 2020.
All right, so what are the big questions that will shape the year of the rat?
The year of the rat.
Yeah, that's the year of the rat. That doesn't actually sound too optimistic.
I don't like the sound of that at all.
But 2020, you know, it's a good time to think about what might shape the new year. And of course, a lot of people are asking this question right now. Will oil prices go higher?
Well, it's a very prescient question right now because of the Iranian situation. The United States, of course, ordered the killing of Qasem Soleimani, the number two person in the Iranian government. And this is a very big deal. We have gone from no geopolitical premium to, I think, about $10, right?
It's hard to say. I would argue $5 has been the result of this geopolitical premium that has evolved over the last week or so.
Yeah. I mean, that term geopolitical premium is nothing new, certainly. I mean, I've been following oil markets for 2 to 3 decades, and I would say 90% of the time there has been a geopolitical premium because of the volatility of Middle Eastern politics. So the period between 2015 and 2019, where effectively there was none because we felt that there was an oversupply from the new shale oil sources and so on, was very unusual. But when we see attacks directly on one of the largest producers in the world, Saudi Arabia, and military tensions escalate to the level they are here, that has reintroduced the premium, which is really a probabilistic price premium based on the fear that there's going to be military conflict that will shut down the Straits of Hormuz.
Well, and then I think there's also the concern that you could take out some major oil production infrastructure as well, depending on what happens here. The reality, though, is the market, in the absence of a major prolonged outage, the market is really well supplied.
Right.
We've got to see some actions that would result in less oil supply for this premium to stick around.
So by well supplied, just to review that, you mean that we have shut in, curtailed effectively production from the OPEC plus group, including the Russians.
Exactly. Like basically at the end of December, they announced that they're going to take even 500,000 barrels a day more off the market because there's so much supply that we were going to have, you know, the tanks filling up. And so we've got surplus capacity right now.
Right. Demand is weakened a little bit from last year?
Yes. Yeah. So we're only going to have about 1 million barrels a day of oil demand, it looks like, for 2019.
That's growth.
Growth. 1 million barrels a day of growth. And I think this year, although the outlooks are a little bit higher when you consider the outlooks for economic growth, it's probably reasonable to think a similar level of growth in 2020.
Right.
And so considering that outlook, there's too much supply. So the question to me is, will this geopolitical premium stick around over the course of the next month or two if we don't see a major outage, a real physical outage?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question because, I mean, oil is a very curious commodity priced right at the margins. If we think about global oil demand with 1 million barrels per day growth still, that's a big number. Like, what are we going from 100 to 101 or 101 to 102? It's a sort of seasonal, whatever the number is. It's over 100. Mm-hmm. And we're saying that it's oversupplied because there's only 1 million or 2 barrels of reserve. That's like a 2% reserve margin, which is really not that much. And to think that several million barrels per day could be taken off market because of military conflict, it doesn't seem to me that it's unreasonable to think that this geopolitical premium is going to linger.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the big question is the market psychology, right? So there's the reality and there's how the market thinks about that. There is a mindset now that there's lots of oil. So we'll have to wait and see. I think the chances of prices staying higher in 2020 with this situation are much probability of that much higher than it was before. But there is still the potential for prices to sag back if it's viewed that this doesn't affect supply. Yeah,
I mean, I don't expect world peace is going to break out in 2020. You know, the unfortunate reality is that this is going to be a volatile commodity with a bias to the upside. And I think the better question to ask is the price of oil going down in 2020? And I think that it's safe to say that there is now a floor that potentially we didn't have, say, coming into 2019 when the price of oil was 45 momentarily. I don't think it's going there for the foreseeable future. So I think companies should probably discount the geopolitical premium.
Yeah, plan for that $55 world, which is kind of the price without the geopolitical premium, assuming OPEC delivers on their cuts and, you know, take advantage of the higher prices when they come, but don't depend on them.
That's exactly right.
Okay, next big question. What's going to happen with U.S. shale oil? Is the boom over?
Well, yes and no. I mean, oil prices were weaker in 2019, so people started saying at these prices and without equity markets funding the Permian and other hot basins for oil supply, that production in the United States is going to roll over. But now we have prices that are solidly in the 60s. I don't think the debt in the equity markets are coming back. I don't think that you're going to see the same level of production growth that we've seen in the last couple of years. But I don't see U.S. oil supply going starting to retreat. Do you?
No. Especially if we stay at the $60 WTI. Yes, they got to give money back to their shareholders, but I think they can do that and still have some growth at the $60. And if we go even higher, I would say there's probably potential for even more supply growth. So the thing with U.S. shale oil is the growth is going to be very dependent on the price of oil. And so as we move into the higher prices, I think you can assume there are going to be more supply from the U.S.
Yeah, I think it's important to think back to 2019 when the investors really did walk from both the Canadian and the U.S. oil producers in terms of funding them with more equity. That effectively instilled a discipline amongst the oil producers, certainly the progressive oil producers, to be able to live within cash flow and actually give some money back to investors. That discipline, I don't think, has yet gone away. No. And the ability to actually produce and potentially even grow without external capital is a big development in the business.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, at $55, arguably not much growth. But as the WTI price goes up, I think you could assume some growth because I think there'll be some extra cash both to pay the investors and still have some growth. But regardless, more modest pace of growth than we've seen over the past several years is what to be expected from the U.S.
Right.
Okay, oil demand, is it going to start peaking anytime soon?
I think it's unlikely in the 2020s. I mean, we just talked about the 1 million barrels per day growth going from, as I say, I've lost track of the numbers momentarily.
It's over 100.
It's over 100. I mean, I think it's 101 to 102. This is just still a staggering amount of oil demand. I don't think it's peaking in the 2020s. We shall see. I mean, it depends on a lot of things. You know, frankly, the thing that the oil producers should be concerned about on the demand side is if the oil price does spike up to $100 a barrel and sustains because of geopolitical issues, that will destroy demand. As it has in the past.
Yes, faster than a carbon tax. The other big thing that could affect demand in the short term is obviously a slowdown in the world economy. You know, the consensus view is that we're going to have growth next year. We're not going to see a recession if you look at major agencies out there. But there is still that concern around the trade wars and if these tariffs sustain through the year, what that will do in terms of
economic
growth.
Or if there is a military conflict in the Middle East, that could affect the world economy too. So there's a lot of uncertainty out there. But structurally, is oil demand going to peak and level out? I would say certainly not in the 2020s. The trends don't appear to demonstrate that at the moment.
Okay, another big important question is, what will OPEC Plus do? You know, they gave us all a Christmas present there with the cut that they announced in December, and it was a needed cut because the market was oversupplied without it. Are they going to stick with these restraints for 2020, which in the absence of an outage would be needed?
Yeah, so, well, first of all, OPEC Plus is the core OPEC group, which is 10 or 11 producers that have been the long-standing members of that cartel, plus the Russians, plus a handful of other smaller producers that have agreed to cut historically, collectively, because of the shale boom in the United States to try and prop up. You know, as a side note, we've talked about this. Oh, isn't that wonderful innovation? Turn off a valve. You know, it's to try and overcome your low price issue.
Yeah. Well, the problem with the strategy, and we're seeing it play out, is every year your production goes down while the others goes up. And yes, you've propped the price of oil up, but at some point your net revenue suffers due to less volume.
Yeah. And it's going to be interesting to see if we see $65, well, Brent is closer to 70. Let's say that sustains. A lot of these OPEC countries realize that full global price. I would argue it makes them somewhat lazy. You know, you're back up to those levels. It's a pretty healthy bump up in your national revenues because most of these countries have state-owned oil companies. And the impetus to innovate, the impetus to take these sorts of actions is much less than it was before.
Yeah. And another interesting new dynamic starting in 2019 is that Saudi Arabia has made Saudi Aramco a public company.
Yeah.
And will that make them even more determined to defend oil price because they don't want their share price to go down?
Yeah, I think so.
It's interesting, you know, with this conflict over the last few days, Aramco's share price has moved down, not up, even though the oil price has gone up. And it's because there's fear that they may lose some supply here.
Yeah, that they're going to get attacked and more of their production is taken out. So very complicated dynamics, but all of which is to say that the combination of the cuts they've instituted with that geopolitical premium is supportive of prices.
Let's talk about COP25 meeting that was held in Madrid in December. By all accounts, a bit of a disappointment.
So this is the big climate change meeting that is the 25th in a series that all the governments of the world are represented at. It was in Madrid, and they're trying to come to some sort of consensus agreement on how to hold accountability to the Paris Agreement, which was signed 4 years ago. It'll be 5 years, actually, in 2020. You know, they didn't make a lot of progress, which is not surprising because trying to get consensus with 190 countries is not easy.
Yeah, so it's interesting. While companies and countries are happy to make 2050 goals, they're not happy to make any near-term adjustments. And so, you know, this is a challenge. I actually think this is going to put more pressure on companies, considering the backdrop of the whole world getting more concerned by this situation. I think you're going to see more pressure for individual companies, public companies, to start making major changes
themselves.
That's
beyond just oil and gas companies.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, beyond oil and gas. Mm-hmm. You know, pledges for utilities, for, you know, cement plants, for different industries to start showing that they're going to contribute because of the lack of action by government policy.
Yeah, certainly in the Western world where we have free market publicly traded companies, they are going to continue to become under more pressure. The ESG rules and sustainable finance things that are coming down the pipe that we've discussed are probably going to harden as we go forward. But I also think that the accountability of the individual is going to become under a greater scrutiny too, because it is a demand side issue as much as it is a supply side issue.
So like the Greta Thunberg type movement is going to result in people flying less, choosing smaller vehicles.
I don't know if it's going to make people fly less, but the pressure for people to fly less is going to increase. How people behave individually, we shall see.
Okay, what will happen with oil and gas equity markets in 2020? Last year obviously was a tough year. We talked about that. Stronger commodity prices alone, are they going to bring back interest in oil and gas equities, do you think?
I think there's going to be some greater interest. We've already seen it early in 2020, late 19. Many of these stocks were really ignored and undervalued, delivering 10 plus percent dividends and so on, which is quite appealing. But I don't think at the same time it's going to be a cascade back into these sorts of stocks. They're still concerned about whether they can sustain making money over the long period, whether they can reduce their emissions and all those sorts of issues that we've talked about before. We have seen a recoupling, haven't we, of oil price?
Yeah, so over the last week or so, we've seen quite a rise in the equity prices along with WTI. But I would say, you know, that alone is probably not enough. I think we're going to have to see companies prove they can return money to investors and at the same time be ESG leaders. There's going to be other metrics that are needed. Oil price alone probably isn't enough to get the stocks having as much interest as they had in the past.
Right.
Okay. Canadian climate change policy. What does it look like going forward?
I think we've had the statement from the Prime Minister post-election that we're going to see a greater push to 2050 for net zero, real results by 2030. Say that I think the oil and gas industry is prepared for it. I mean, this is something that is being talked about now for 2-3 years in a very intense way, certainly in the last year. I think the onus is going to be on other industries in this country on how they're going to come up with a net zero by 2050 plan. Industries that haven't really been under similar pressures as oil and gas, that are high emitters, say cement, steel, even transportation, and so on. I think the onus is going to be on them far more than the oil and gas business.
Yeah, to me, it's actually not really much of a question. If you look at Justin Trudeau's mandate letter to the Minister of Environment and Climate Change released in December, it's pretty clear. He's talking about legally binding 5-year emission reduction milestones, 2030 goal, 2050 goal.
Yeah.
And he talks about the consumers too. There's the single-use plastic ban, but there's also a goal to have 100% electric vehicles in Canada by 2040.
You mean in sales?
New vehicles.
Sales, yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, 2040 is still 20 years away. Lots can happen.
Let's look at Alberta oil markets. Do you think wide differentials will come in the new year?
No, I don't think so. We already talked about that in our 2019 review. I think we've seen more pipeline capacity, more rail capacity. I think we've seen production side discipline, the impetus to be able to deliver profitability over production growth. So I think we're going to be okay on that front.
Yeah, and Alberta government monitoring how much takeaway we have to make sure that supply is aligned. Yeah.
I think that actually you'll probably see the curtailment lifted by the end of the year, if not before.
All right. Western Canadian natural gas markets. Have we turned a corner? Is 2020 going to be a better year than 2019?
Well, I think the policies that we talked about earlier are very positive in terms of oversupply versus takeaway capacity. I mean, what do you think?
I think it's looking a lot better. Production has curtailed a bit naturally.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we are getting some new takeaway capacity this year. And we have this new supportive policy around maintenance periods. So prices, the problem may come from Henry Hub, because North American prices in general look to be weaker in 2020 than last year, because there's a lot of supply. But in terms of the difference between our prices and the American prices, I think it's going to be much more stable and narrow than it was in the past year.
I agree with all that, except that I think that natural gas producers aren't going to sleep better until probably 2022 to 2024, five, when more pipe takeaway capacity comes in, and then ultimately LNG.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, the things will be more stable and better, but I don't foresee a whole bunch of new investment in Western Canada gas production.
No.
Okay, finally, the big question, Peter, is 2020 going to be better than 2019? Well, please say yes.
Well, from a price perspective, yes. I think that commodity prices for both oil and for natural gas are going to be as good or better than last year. And as I said earlier, I think the downside has been substantially taken away and the bias is to the upside. So from that perspective, I think it's going to be a better year. I think it's going to be a better year in terms of the diversification of the transportation, which you talked about earlier. And really, it's all a setup for, I think, a leaner, meaner, cleaner oil and gas and industry and energy industry at large, with the renewables coming in for Alberta and Western Canada as we go into the 2020s.
Okay, so lots to look forward to in the new year.
Yeah, I think so.
And we look forward to covering a lot of these topics in a lot more detail as the year evolves. So thank you for listening to our podcast. If you like this podcast, please rate it on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about it.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.